Dr. Boyle.
Thank you, everybody. So my claim to fame is that I'm Mary Ann's brother, the girl who wrote the book. So it's kind of difficult being introduced on the foot of your younger sister, especially when she's as witty as Mary Ann. But I give her great credit for getting me working more in naltrexone. And I'm going to tell you my naltrexone story as a family physician. I'm a little bit unusual as a family doc because I've got a special interest with infertility. So just to give you a bit of my own background, that I completed my family physician training in July of 97, and 6 months later, in February of 1998, I opened my own private practice specializing in the treatment of infertility and miscarriage using a crazy new system called NAPRO Technology and Fertility Care. And this is a system that's been developed by a consultant obstetrician gynecologist, Dr. Thomas Hilders, here in the United States in Omaha, Nebraska. To date, I've treated about 3,000 patients, many successfully after years of infertility, failed IVF, and multiple recurrent miscarriages. This is the thing that I talk mostly about. Last weekend, I was giving a presentation in Slovakia. I've also been to Italy, Portugal, Croatia, Switzerland. I've given a couple of talks in the UK, the United States, and Ireland. And this is my main passion. And this is most of what I do. I'm really busy at the work that I do. My waiting list, I've got about 80 patients on my waiting list, which is about a six-month waiting list, so I don't need more work. And naltrexone doesn't help in that regard. I'm glad to say I've moved to a posh new place, and this is the foyer when people come in. We've got a piano that plays itself. It's the Galway Clinic. In Ireland, it's a state-of-the-art private hospital, and it says what I wanted to say about how serious this infertility treatment is that I provide. I've always known about naltrexone from my medical training, that being an opioid receptor antagonist for alcoholics and drug addicts, and its dosage. And I was also familiar that Dr. Hilders, who developed NAPRO technology, was using it as a fertility treatment for about 10 years. And I hadn't been using it much until recently, thanks to Mary Ann. Now, when Hilders would use this, he would always do a blood test to confirm endorphin deficiency in the first place. It's one of our policies. If it's not broken, don't fix it. And I think it's an answer somebody was asking earlier on, how do I know if I should be taking naltrexone? Well, I think we should know what the normal parameters for endorphin levels are, establish what the normal profile is, and then if you deviate from normal, then you're an endorphin deficient and that should be treated. In any case, Hilders would measure the blood tests on days 5, 7, and 9 after ovulation because, as the question I posed to Professor Jill Smith earlier, there's a cyclical variability. Every day of the month, a woman is going to have a different level of endorphin depending on what stage of the cycle she's at. So this is very important when you're trying to measure endorphin levels. So they should either be measured early in the cycle or later in the cycle, but around the time of ovulation, they take a significant drop. So Hilders has been using it off-label to treat, of all things, resistant premenstrual syndrome for patients that wouldn't respond to our usual hormonal treatments. He's also been using it to treat infertility as an adjunct to the NAPRO technology fertility treatment. But the way that he was using it was quite a bit different. And because there are so many side effects from naltrexone, he used to give 0.25 milligrams four times a day for 10 days. After 10 days, he doubled that to 0.5 of a milligram, four times a day, 1 milligram, and so on, up to 8 milligrams. The results in treating PMS weren't hugely convincing. I did my training with him in 1995, and at that time, it was really just kind of something he was looking at and wasn't really getting very good results. And we could get good improvement in PMS treatment, far superior to the most commonly recommended treatment, which is Ceroxat. And the treatment is far superior with hormonal treatment alone. And when it was combined with naltrexone, there was marginal, if any, improvement. It wasn't statistically significant. So I didn't use it. It was impossible for me to get beta endorphin levels measured. I'm intrigued to see how Professor Smith gets them measured because since December 2003, Dr. Hilders hasn't been able to get them measured in the United States unless he's been able to resource it since. It's a very delicate. He's got his own lab, and it's just the company that made the reagents stopped making them, so he couldn't actually get it measured anymore. It's a very delicate blood sample. You've got to take it, and within 30 minutes, it's got to be centrifuged. And if it's going to be sent to a lab to be analyzed, it's got to go on dry ice and be frozen, and then analyzed within 24 to 48 hours. I perceived it as being not that important anyway, and it was, even if I did experiment with a few people, it was a difficult treatment to prescribe four times a day and get it made up by a compounding pharmacist, and it was going to be murder trying to get patient compliance, so I just didn't like it. And then along comes Marianne, and she says, Dr. Marianne has been on the internet, and she tells me that she's going to take Noel off his interferons and put him on naltrexone. And for once, I actually agreed with her. And I said, well, Mary, he's not doing so good otherwise. So she told me it was this new treatment found by a neurologist. His primary progressive MS was getting worse, and no improvement by the interferons. In any case, it's not licensed for that anyway. So I've brushed up my Latin and primum non nocere, first do no harm. I said, well, look, you've nothing to lose, like Susie said earlier, nothing to lose and possibly everything to gain. What have you got to lose by trying it? So he went on it, and his she was convinced that the progression of his MS had stopped. And that was interesting, and I thought, well, that's great. And I didn't see any connection between my fertility work at that time. And still later, I went and I heard Robert, an MS patient who started naltrexone again on Marianne's advice. He was in Galway. And he was talking from personal experience of how this drug had transformed his life. And it knocked my socks off. I said, this is huge. This guy's life has been totally changed. He was on all the interferons, and it's incredible. And it's not placebo, because he had symptoms of MS and rheumatoid arthritis, debilitating fatigue. And I think it is a very important point, whoever said it, that fatigue doesn't describe enough the profound tiredness that somebody experiences. Everybody gets tired, but the tiredness that somebody has with an autoimmune condition is profound, and we need to coin a new phrase to measure that. So we started the naltrexone, and one of the things I found from patients I put on it is the dramatic lift in their energy. And his was dramatic, plus the relief of his joint pain and no further progression of his MS, except when he ran out. And this gets rid of the placebo part, because, or if he forgets to take it for a time, and the symptoms would come back, but always be controlled once you get back on the treatment. So I looked into it and heard what Dr. Bahari was doing for HIV, the autoimmune conditions, and the kind of dosages that he was using for it as a single tablet at night. And the theory given that taking it at night, giving the brief temporary block, gives a threefold increase in endorphin levels. So I looked up the circadian rhythm of endorphins from 2 o'clock in the morning till 11 o'clock at night. They surge during the nighttime hours, and they come down during the day. And the thinking being, if you block the receptors at night, you'll give an exaggerated endorphin surge at the early during the night, so that as the endorphins peter out during the day, they're going to gradually dip. Whereas if you start at a low, you're going to be low the whole time. So this is the working theory behind it, to get it up that hump and then let it gradually drop during the day, which is where our four times daily dose with NAPRO technology was letting us down, as opposed to the single nighttime dose. So to me, I said, I'm so busy, I do not need to be a hero or a pioneer for naltrexone. I mean, people will be lining up to put patients on this. It's fantastic, low toxicity, it won't do any harm. It's inexpensive, highly effective, easy to take. You don't need specialized physician training. All you need is your medical license and a prescription pad and a paper. And there are few, if any, ethical issues. And I would anticipate widespread use and acceptance very quickly, but I was surprised. There was huge resistance among doctors to even consider trying it out. So because it's unlicensed, it's regarded as an experimental treatment. It's not evidence-based. Doctors aren't covered by their medical malpractice, and it's simply too risky. So what level of evidence is there to support the use of naltrexone? Well, evidence-based medicine is meant to inform us what level of evidence do we have for the practices we engage in. It's not designed to stifle trying new things. It's just designed to admit we don't have all the evidence we'd like to have, but here's the evidence we have for the treatment we have under consideration. And I think the greatest mistake for evidence-based medicine is that unless it's a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study, that it can't possibly work. And I think that's something that the medical profession in general is going to suffer seriously from unless we address it and say, you don't need that. You need good clinical judgment, you need to make a good clinical assessment, and then you declare the level of evidence you have, and then you attempt a treatment and judge the outcome, even by clinical experience. But so long as the patient is informed that this is what's going on. So we had the theoretical, there's clinical experience of over 400 MS patients with Dr. Bahari, over 2,000 patients in the United States, but just it's unpublished yet. And thanks be to God, Professor Smith is going to change all of that, and I'm so excited about her data coming out because that's got scientific teeth. So I decided, well, let's try it out. After I heard Robert trying it, let's try it in some autoimmune people that I encounter from time to time. A 44-year-old male friend of mine with psoriatic arthropathy, I put him on the naltrexone. I bought it, I paid for it, I gave it to him, said, try this, see how you get on with it. He tried it, took it for 6 weeks, didn't work, and he quit it. But it didn't do any harm either. So then I thought, well, he's had that for 20 years and maybe he wasn't the best person to try it on, but attempt number one, failure. Attempt number two, another friend of mine, chronic inactive rheumatoid arthritis with joint damage and pain, but there was no active, her energy levels were good and it wasn't actively getting worse. She just had the chronic destructive part and it seemed to be in remission. So I put her on it and again, no improvement and no harm. My first success came with the third person I tried on it, a friend of mine, 33-year-old, who had acute early-onset rheumatoid arthritis, and he had dramatic improvement. I'll show you his case in just a minute. I also tried it on an infertile patient with rheumatoid arthritis, and then a 66-year-old male. I'll just go through these three cases, actually. So the first one that worked, he was in good health. His uncle, he had a positive family history, an uncle with severe debilitating rheumatoid arthritis. And from December of 2003, he got gradual onset of finger and wrist pains on and off for about 12 months. Low energy, severe heartburn, but no swelling, just pain in his joints and profound fatigue. He was seen by the rheumatologist and all the blood tests were inconclusive. He was prescribed non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and he continued to deteriorate to the extent that he was unable to play with his two-year-old son when he'd come home after work. He had to go to bed very early to rest and he was especially stiff and tired in the mornings. I convinced him to try naltrexone, rapid dramatic improvement, no fatigue, no joint pain, no heartburn. And he ran out of it one day. He was 4 days short of it. And he called around to my house and he just said how rotten he was. And I got so excited because I saw how bad and debilitated he was without naltrexone. He was 4 days without it and he was crashing. He said he had to go back on all of his non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. He had to go to bed again. He was stiff, sore and tired in the morning and he couldn't wait till his supply would come in again of the naltrexone. So he's presently on it and he's very stable. So I approached my local rheumatologist in my fancy hospital, and sadly, he wasn't interested, and the usual arguments were trotted out to me that you cannot judge efficacy of a new treatment with one case. And the common adage that one sparrow doesn't make a summer, okay, probably placebo, risky experiment. If it doesn't work and joint damage occurs, then you're potentially liable for that because there's a new push with the rheumatoid drugs. Get them on it early, get them on it fast, prevent joint destruction, and you're going to save them a lifetime of problems. So there's a big push in the rheumatology sphere, get them on it fast, and early treatment then prevents disability. So then I had a patient in my infertility practice, 36-year-old female who had a previous diagnosis of polycystic ovaries and 10 years of infertility, who had a baby already in her program with that kind of a history, and she was coming back for number two. So I had her on her treatment, and she got her first episode of acute onset of rheumatoid arthritis, went to the rheumatologist, was diagnosed with rheumatoid, resistant to non-steroidals, and was told, you need methotrexate. And of course, with methotrexate, you can't conceive. So she came to me and said, I thought you might have something better. I says, well, it's funny you happen to come to me because I do. But before that, just methotrexate is classified as an anti-metabolite drug, which means it's capable of blocking the metabolism of cells. It's helpful in treating diseases associated with abnormally rapid cell growth, breast cancer, psoriasis. In treating rheumatoid arthritis, it seems to work by altering aspects of immune function, which may play a role in rheumatoid arthritis. It can cause serious liver damage. It can suppress the body's immunity. It can impair fertility, decrease sperm count, if you're a man, cause menstrual dysfunction. It can be toxic to the embryo, and it can cause fetal defects and spontaneous abortion. Not a pretty drug. The most frequent reactions, side effects would include mouth sores, stomach upset, low white blood cell counts, can cause severe toxicity of the liver and bone marrow, which require regular monitoring with blood testing. It can cause headache, drowsiness, which may resolve if the dose is lowered, and it can cause itching, skin rash, dizziness, hair loss, etc., etc., etc. So when you're looking at this, and if there's an alternative that you can give rather than this monster, you're doing your patient a great big favor. So we said, let's try urinaltrexone. Rapid 80% improvement in her symptoms, absolutely zero side effects for her. She conceived two cycles later while on our fertility treatment at the same time and had a successful pregnancy. At that time, I hadn't made the link that the naltrexone also improved her fertility, but I'll show you that later on. Later then, there's a 66-year-old male resistant to methotrexate. He was married, high blood pressure, high lipids, overweight, but otherwise in general good health. December 2004, acute onset of his first episode of rheumatoid arthritis. Low energy for 3 to 4 months preceding that. Felt like he was walking on stones. Had swollen, painful joints, elbows, fingers, knees, ankles. He was unable to shave. He couldn't comb his hair. Couldn't get dressed on his own. He was walking with crutches with extreme difficulty. He was really in a bad way with this. Between March and August of 2005, he was treated with methotrexate 10 milligrams weekly and Mobic, meloxicam 15 milligrams a day. He continued to deteriorate. July of 2005, he was told that he would need Enbrel, so the anti-TNF or TNF, I'm not even totally up to date with that, but injections because the methotrexate wasn't working. I got this information from Enbrel.com for anybody who's interested in it, and it's a potent immunosuppressive treatment. It's licensed for the treatment of moderate to severe rheumatoid arthritis, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, severe ankylosing spondylitis, psoriatic arthritis, and moderate to severe chronic plaque psoriasis. So I think the naltrexone would work for my friend with the psoriasis as well, by the way, but it's just I think he's one of these who needed to be on it for longer. In post-marketing use, the following serious adverse effects have been reported. People have died with this. You can get infections and sepsis, including fatalities. You can get CNS demyelinating disorders such as MS. So maybe by suppressing the immune system, might there be a link that that might increase the likelihood of developing MS as well? Rare cases of pancytopenia, including aplastic anemia, some of which have been fatal. In clinical trials of all TNF inhibitors, a higher rate of lymphoma was seen compared to the general population. So you take this, you could die, you could get MS, and you could get cancer. Not a great drug. And here's the other side effects that are more common. You can get injection site reactions, infection, headache. In juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, the infections were even higher. 62% of the young people taking it for their arthritis developed infections. 19% got headaches, abdominal pain, vomiting, nausea. So not a pretty drug. The alternatives are pretty bleak out there. It's not like naltrexone has a lot of competition. Just because it's licensed does not mean it's safe. I think that's something very important to remember. Things are licensed sometimes, I think, out of desperation because you're saying, what else can we do? I think the people giving it are doing it in good faith, and they're saying, we've got to do something. They're melting before our eyes. Let's try and suppress their immune system, and, well, maybe a few of them will die, et cetera, et cetera. But we have to weigh and risk benefit versus risk and decide, well, with naltrexone, I think there's nearly an obligation, even with the limited data that's available, to consider trying it. So anyway, we decided to put him on it before going for Enbrel. Immediate dramatic improvement. Within 2 weeks, he was walking without his crutches. I saw him for a review on the 10th of February with absolutely no side effects, and his rheumatologist was simply not interested. I don't know what to do. Except to say, well, actually, I know of a Professor Smith who's actually publishing some very good data on this. Maybe you might consider it and use it yourself, because I'm not trained in research. I'm trained in clinical practice, and I can pick up things from clinical practice. I give something and it works. I try it in somebody and it works again. I say, this works. So it's not that difficult. But I know to convince the broader scientific community, you got to go through all that really complicated stuff that's fantastic, and it's irrefutable then. So later cases then, Bernadette, a 26-year-old single girl with relapsing remitting MS, depression and polycystic ovaries, She was coming to me. I'll just go through these as they come up. So she had relapsing remitting MS diagnosed in 1999 by MRI, lumbar puncture, and optic atrophy. She was coming to me because of irregular cycles and polycystic ovaries, and she felt extremely depressed in the oral contraceptive pill and wanted to come off it, and was trying our approach because we regulate the cycle with natural progesterone. And so I put her on cyclical progesterone and Glucophage, a diabetic tablet to treat women with polycystic ovaries, but that's another day's work. So while she was coming to me, she had five relapses of her relapsing remitting MS between 1999 and 2005. And obviously during that time, I told her, by the way, Mary Ann's book, etc. And normally I tell people, look, if you're going to go for naltrexone, read the book, look up the website, inform yourself, you decide, do you want this or not? I'm not trying to sell it to you. If you decide you want it, that's up to you. And if you do, go to your doctor, go to your specialist and badger them and try and get it. If that fails, in conscience, I can't deny this drug to you. But I want you to try and get it through your own channels first. I don't want to be seen to be poaching patients from other doctors. I want them to have first refusal, and hopefully they won't refuse. So she went to her usual channels, and her neurologist and general practitioner refused treatment and was advised Copaxone. So Copaxone, what's that? It's indicated for the reduction in frequency of relapses in ambulatory, that's walking patients, with relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis, characterized by at least two attacks of neurological dysfunction over the previous two-year period. So if you've got relapsing remitting MS and you've had two acute episodes within 2 years, you're a suitable candidate for this. Not indicated for primary or secondary progressive MS. You've got to avoid pregnancy. You can get side effects such as flushing, chest pain, shortness of breath, racing heart, palpitations within minutes of the injection. It can make your anxiety and depression worse, which she already had plenty of, and she was on an antidepressant. Dizziness, rash, swelling, and this occurs in greater than 10% of patients taking it. So again, not a big competitor against naltrexone. So we put her on it in October of 05, improved energy, improved mood, no relapse since April of, since I saw her just, I was on the phone to her a week ago, in fact, and she was feeling fantastic on it, and very, very keen to stay on her naltrexone. And she was one of the ones that responded more gradually, but it's really profound at this stage. The first 2 to 3 months, she wasn't sure, but after the 3 months, she's definite with it now. She's actually glowing with it. Her mood improved, and it does have antidepressive qualities, and her cycles became more regular. It does improve fertility. The next girl, a 34-year-old, came to me because she read Marianne's book, and she's married with two children, chronic progressive MS. I didn't figure if it was primary or secondary. She diagnosed by MRI and lumbar puncture in October of 05. She'd been on interferon injections for 5 years. She came to me, difficulty walking with a stick, extreme fatigue, reduced power in her arms and legs, difficulty writing, and my interest, nasty premenstrual symptoms lasting for 7 days and long irregular cycles. Interferons, well, what's that? For relapsing remitting MS, but it's only licensed, and it's also licensed for secondary progressive, but not primary progressive MS. The efficacy of treatment for longer than 2 years hasn't been sufficiently demonstrated for relapsing remitting MS, so the level of data to support the current drugs is pretty weak. And for secondary progressive MS, the efficacy for a period of 2 years within or 3 years, so 2 to 3 years is all the... Now, this is what I got from the medicines.ie website, so it's the Irish drug formulary to inform us about medications. And again, it lists the brutal side effects, the flu-like symptoms, pain in muscles and joints, and injection site reactions, severe anxiety, depression to the point of suicide. People have killed themselves in this. It gives a profound, nasty depression. And insomnia, dizziness, injection site necrosis in about 5% of the patients who take it. And that can be pretty severe, sometimes needing plastic surgery to repair it. And the list of side effects went on and on and on, too many for me to mention at this time, but unpleasant stuff. And if you could avoid it, you're better off. You can get liver damage, which could be mild or transient. Rarely, the severe liver injury has been caused, reported with fatalities as well. So anyway, this stuff wasn't working, and we said, okay, your neurologist says you're on the interferon, and I know absolutely nothing about MS. I'm a GP by training, and I just happen to have a brother-in-law who is on it, and he's doing well with this naltrexone, and I'm afraid telling you maybe you should stop your naltrexone or stop your interferon with a view to starting naltrexone. But if I was you, I'd do it. And it's got to be your call because this is purely experimental and I'm going out on a limb and you can sue my butt if something goes wrong with this. And I tell patients that. And they normally say they won't sue me, so I'm not using it for long enough to find out if that's true. And it is a risk. It is a bit of a risk. And I think that if you engage with somebody, and I usually spend about 40 minutes with the patients, and we really talk it through, and I kind of walk with them through it, and I kind of really try to get a good handle on what's going on with it. And I try and say, you know, this is your decision. It's not me putting it on you, and you've informed yourself, et cetera, et cetera. And by reading the book and being informed, she made the decision herself because it's very dangerous for me to say I'm giving you advice different than your neurologist. That's her decision to make. And if she wants to make that decision, well, I'd be happy to oblige and give the naltrexone. But a month later, she calls me and says, your classic miracle drug, I'm walking without my crutches. So I thought that was pretty cool. And I got her to come back for review. I want to see these people. I want to look them in the eye. And I want to look and I want to see that this is not a placebo effect. This is real. And when she came in, the first time I saw her, she was drawn, gray, haggard, dour, sad, really just dragged herself to be there and had the weight of the world on her shoulders. She came skipping in, bright-eyed, smiling, without her stick. And I said, girl, you are so different. You have really changed. Dramatic improvement in her energy and mood. She used to have to go to bed at 4 or 5 o'clock every afternoon. Her husband's life was transformed. Her kid's life was transformed. She had two young girls. She said within days, the sensation that she had previously lost had turned into her feet. No longer was she walking on cotton wool. She was walking on the floor again. And she was delighted. And there are a few things in life that give me more pleasure than helping patients with infertility have a child, but naltrexone comes very, very close. So the side effects that she did get, she said it was like her brain was waking up. And I guess I didn't start with the low dose at 1.5 and 3 milligrams and build it up. I went straight for 4.5. And she said she slept for 1 hour the first night, 2 hours the next night. But by the end of a week or two, she was able to sleep much better. And she suggested maybe I should start with a lower dose. So I'm open to that kind of feedback from somebody, I would say, and I can learn from her and say, okay, let's do 1.5 or 2 milligrams to start with and build it up. But she's perfect now and obviously delighted. And now I'm starting to get bold. Now I feel, hang on a minute here, we've got something we can really work with here. This drug kicks butt. And now I don't have the data to back it up, but I've got clinical experience and I'm looking at patients right before my eyes. I've heard people say it and I've tried it for myself and I have seen the promise delivered in practice, and it's stunning. And the frightening thing is to think how many people are being deprived the benefits of this fantastic drug because of doctors being too frightened to prescribe it for all the wrong reasons. We're not frightened to prescribe it because it's going to cause a fatality or because it's going to cause an infection. We're frightened because we might get sued. It's a real fear. We've got to look out for it. But this girl is also frightened of her MS society. The one area where she should have support, she actually has hostility and antagonism. And sadly, I think a lot of the MS societies are funded by drug companies. And if you say something that's going to affect the drug company, then it reflects poorly in the MS society and they're not impartial. So she's frightened about telling her colleagues and her friends, her fellow sufferers of MS, how she got better, because there's a hostility to that view. She's frightened of her neurologist, and so am I. So I'm saying, don't say anything, skip your appointments, don't show up. I want to get at least 20 people like you, and then I'll get together with Dr. Crowley and we'll say, look, we've got 40 people, 50 people, and here they all are, here are their stories. There's a whole bunch of clinical cases there, so we're getting pretty close to it. But even better again, I keep coming back to Professor Smith's data. It's so, so important to convince the broader medical community, because that's science at its best. It's super. She had tears in her eyes and makes me choke a little as well to thank my sister for her book, and she's changed my life. So fair play to you, Marianne. It's fantastic. And for everybody involved in this work, it's great. And it's really important for everybody who's come here, because, you know, you really do change lives with this. Fibromyalgia, I've treated two patients, one with fibromyalgia and endometriosis. She couldn't tolerate the drug at all. So the original 0.25 milligram dose that we're using in the States four times a day, I'm giving that once at night for her now. And if I build this up, I'm convinced we're going to get her sorted as well. But she couldn't even tolerate the 1.5. She had really nasty side effects and was very ill with this. But there's nothing else she can actually try. So I tried her on 4.5 and she was terrible with it. We went to 1.5, terrible again. Now we're 0.25. So she's building up the courage to try it again and hopefully it'll work. Another girl with fibromyalgia that I've put on it, it took her 2 months before she noticed gradual improvement of her symptoms, improved energy and reduced pain. And she didn't realize how well she was until she ran out of her naltrexone and all the symptoms came back. And I saw her in that intervening period before she got her refill of her prescription. And she was very clear how good the naltrexone made her feel. Chronic fatigue, 20-year-old female. She had a strong family history of autoimmune conditions. Her mum had endometriosis, which I'll explain to you is actually autoimmune. And she had symptoms herself also, very painful periods. My working theory is, and I'll explain it to you a little bit later on, is that we may have stumbled across a way to prevent the further spread of endometriosis. So far, nobody in the infertility world knows how to do that. We know how to remove it surgically, but it keeps coming back. I believe it's related to immune disorder, and I believe that if we have women on naltrexone, it's not going to come back. That's the working theory. I'll show you the data that I have to back that in a minute. It's something that we may well be able to conserve her lifetime fertility as well as lift her chronic fatigue. And I only got verbal confirmation by the phone that she's feeling much better in her energy levels. I haven't yet seen her for review. I've tried a guy with polymyalgia rheumatica and a young 8-year-old girl with an autoimmune polyendocrinopathy. The guy with polymyalgia had been on steroids and he stopped his steroids. We put him on the naltrexone and he got worse. I saw him 2 weeks later and he was much, much worse. And I said, look, we'll stick it out for another 2 weeks and see where we're at. But if you don't get better after another 2 weeks, I'm losing courage, I'm going to stop it. And I'm also worried about giant cell arteritis, which is a relative of that, that if you got something like that, that we need to put him on buckets of steroids. So I'm a little bit out of my comfort zone doing this because I really haven't read a whole lot in it. But they're dead keen to do it because he just doesn't want to be on steroids. So this is one of my more uncomfortable ones. And I was discussing it with Dr. Crowley, and he was saying that his treatment failures have usually been with patients who have been on steroids first. So I think that's something we really need to take into account as well. This young girl, my heart goes out to her. She's 8 years old, an autoimmune polyendocrinopathy, the biggest monster of an autoimmune disorder I've ever heard of. Never learned about it through my medical training, but it's where the autoimmune system goes berserk and attacks nearly every system in her body. It's already taken out her parathyroid gland, so she's on parathyroid hormone replacement and calcium supplements for the rest of her life. It's going to go after her thyroid, her ovaries. She's got malabsorption. It's going after her whole body in a big, bad way. There's absolutely no treatment she can take except symptomatic relief when the different things come on, including diabetes, and she's likely going to need insulin injections for it. And she's wrecked, no energy the whole time. Now, I've been given her the oral solution, which is very interesting because I so want to put her on that transdermal cream. I think she got worse, this girl. She got a little bit better when I started her on the naltrexone. There was some improvement. But then she developed abnormal liver function, low calcium, was really quite ill, had to go into hospital and be admitted, and we stopped the naltrexone. Now I know the next step. I'm not an expert in naltrexone. I came here to learn something, and I did. I learned about the transdermal cream, and this is going to be ideal for this girl. And I'm very, very hopeful because of what naltrexone has done for other people with immune-related disorders. I think because of her malabsorption, that she didn't get the delivery of the naltrexone that she needed. And I think with the cream, she's actually going to get that. And I think that's why we've had a treatment failure for her. So hopefully the cream is going to come to our rescue. The abnormal liver function, maybe it's an autoimmune hepatitis. So what do? Naltrexone can actually, at very high doses of 300 milligrams, it can affect liver function. I don't believe the doses that I put on could possibly affect this girl's liver. And in fact, I would think increasing the dose of her naltrexone will improve her liver function by reducing the autoimmune hepatitis that I suspect is causing the raised liver enzymes in the first place. I'm no expert in this, but I believe in naltrexone. And The hard thing is her specialist pediatrician, they've asked him and he's refused it, even though there's absolutely nothing else and you can give this non-toxic thing. Well, it's a shot in the dark, but and there's nothing written about it, but it won't do any harm and it might work. Well, why not try it? So we've tried it, but we haven't informed him yet, which is a really awkward place to be because we need to inform him, but we're wondering, well, I want to tell him when she's getting better with it and have him take it over. And it's really, really awkward. So, with all this naltrexone coming up in all the clinical cases, I said, what about my fertility patients? And what is Hilders, the developer of all this infertility work, saying about naltrexone for infertility? Because that's where I really first heard about it, apart from the drug addict side of things. So this is his textbook that I had the privilege of contributing two chapters to, naprotechnology.com, and it explains the medical and surgical practice of this new approach to managing infertility. And it goes back to simple things, just understand the basics. And your body speaks a language. This is the language of the body. The menstrual bleeding pattern tells you something. Mucus flow tells you something. The length of the cycle tells you something. We know what a normal cycle should look like, and we know what normal hormones, how they should surge around the menstrual cycle. We know that it's highly reliable as a method of family planning and as a contraceptive. It's directly comparable to the contraceptive pill published in the Journal of Reproductive Medicine in 1998. And so we know it's highly effective for 17,000 cycles. But could it be telling us something more? And this is tied in with naltrexone, so it'll be worth you suffering this little bit of a jaunt into the infertility world. So, and we recognize patterns, or rather Dr. Hilders did, that were associated with infertility, progesterone deficiency, miscarriage, abnormal bleeding, etc. And it's, at its simplest level, we use a whole range of medical and surgical interventions to correct abnormal fertility care charting patterns, subtle hormonal deficiencies, ovulation defects, and surgical structural abnormalities. And I'm going to add a fifth on there, immunological disorders with naltrexone. Because when I started with this, I thought maybe 5%, maybe 10% of my patients would need it. It's actually closer to 50. It's huge. I looked at what Hilders wrote, and he said in high dose, he started to get great results with naltrexone, but he switched it. Instead of four times a day, he started to give it as a single dose at night. He measured the endorphin levels before and after naltrexone to confirm that the endorphin levels increased as a result of giving naltrexone. And the results for premenstrual symptoms were huge, that before we did get improvement of like 34 to 42%, but now we've got 90% marked dramatic improvement in premenstrual symptoms, which brings us to a new level, because we know if you've got chronic resistant PMS, it's going to be much harder for you to have a successful pregnancy. So this is a marker we use. We sort the PMS, we're going to sort the fertility problem as well. He also noticed an improvement in psychiatric disorders, depression, bipolar disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and a lot of patients would gradually discontinue their psychiatric medications when they were on their naltrexone because they felt so much better. 75% of women with infertility or recurrent miscarriages have these premenstrual symptoms. Is there a link? I'm thinking 50% for naltrexone. Who knows? I don't think it's 75%. He's measured the endorphin levels, and this is normal fertility versus infertility with endometriosis, and it's statistically significant difference for a p-value of less than 0.01. So we know there's a statistically significant link between endorphin deficiency and infertility, especially infertility with endometriosis. Furthermore, 50% of women with polycystic ovaries also have endometriosis. So infertility, endometriosis, polycystic ovary disease, could it be something to do with endorphin deficiency? There have been studies published about polycystic ovaries with elevated insulin levels being greatly improved with high dose of naltrexone. That's the list of studies. I could give them to somebody later on if you want them. And we're also wondering, apart from that, could it also do something on the immune level? This is a part direct from the textbook that I just so got to read to you, because it's been thought for a number of years that endometriosis may be associated with some type of alteration in cell-mediated immunity. In fact, endometriosis fulfills all of the classic characteristics of an autoimmune disease: polyclonal B-cell activation, tissue damage, multi-organ involvement, female preponderance, familial occurrence. There's a much higher incidence of autoimmune diseases with those with endometriosis. I've seen that so much in practice. Increased concurrence with other autoimmune diseases. In women with endometriosis, there's a defect in natural killer cell activity. The natural killer cell activity of the peritoneal fluid mononuclear cells is decreased in endometriosis. So this is hugely significant, and the substantial evidence indicates that endometriosis shares many similarities with autoimmune diseases. So the idea is naltrexone. It's got to stop this in its tracks. I'm even going further to think, how much will it remove the endometriosis that's already established there? Because so far we've got to go surgical if we want to remove it, and I don't know, these are the references that back that up. It's also been identified that there are high concentrations of anti-ovarian antibodies associated with polycystic ovaries. This suggests that an autoimmune reaction is also associated with polycystic ovaries, and that naltrexone may well solve that. So, Enbrel. Back to Enbrel again. There's a guy, Dr. Alan Beers, he's an immunologist in Chicago, treats recurrent miscarriages as an immunological base. I'm nearly done, sorry. And what he does, he gives Enbrel as an immune-modifying agent, and he moved the abnormal chart to normal with Enbrel. And we know if you move a chart from abnormal to normal, now you're really humming. But this isn't, it's dangerous to take in pregnancy, and it's got so many other side effects. I'm seeing this effect now with naltrexone as a much safer immune-modifying agent, giving the same thing and improving fertility rates. So I've got a whole chunk of infertility patients, but I've run out of time, so I think you get the picture. So thank you.
We have 15 minutes for questions and answers.
I'll start at the bottom and work up. Okay.
You mentioned early on a case of a woman who became pregnant after she had started LDN, and she had had an autoimmune disease and was happily became pregnant. Did you continue the LDN throughout the pregnancy?
My advice is to continue naltrexone for at least the first 3 weeks of pregnancy until we do our ultrasound scan and confirm viability, and sometimes it goes as far as 12 weeks. I'm a little concerned because of its potential to reduce growth in cells. So beyond 12 weeks, especially when the placenta starts to take over, I'm shy of using it at that point. But for the early stages, I'm happy enough to use it, because I think if somebody needs it to get pregnant, they need it to keep them pregnant, especially in the early stages. Progesterone is a very strong immunosuppressive hormone as well. So after 12 weeks, the levels of progesterone should be sufficient to prevent an immune thing causing further pregnancy loss.
I was intrigued by this case of a fellow with psoriasis. I was sharing with some people at the conference that I myself started taking low-dose naltrexone several years ago because I have a mild form of guttate psoriasis. And I didn't notice any change for 3 months. And then one day my wife was checking my scalp and she said, "I don't see anything. You're completely clear of lesions." And then over the next couple of months, I saw the rest of the lesions on my body fade and disappear. And to this day, I have a fraction on my body of what was there originally. So I think you need to stick with it beyond 6 weeks.
I met him last week, and I told him that as well.
Yeah.
But at the time, he was patient number two, and I hadn't enough experience,
right,
but I
right.
agree.
I'll also just add, I've also noticed, just accidentally, that my symptoms of IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, which I've had all my life, disappeared after I started taking LDN. So something's happening.
Super.
Yeah.
Leslie.
This is a very stimulating paper extending our horizons into gynecology and new horizons for autoimmune disease. But a practical note, that there are so many people, as mentioned several times, there's a great many skeptics or people hunting for skepticism. And the flip side of your success in encouraging fertility could be that some of the people in this conference or who read about it on the web will be women who will be taking low-dose naltrexone for other conditions, MS, dermatologic, bowel problems, and so on. And if you have found that it promotes fertility, perhaps we should give a warning, a serious note, that note to women of childbearing age. There have been some scattered reports that this compound may promote pregnancy or fertility. lest it somehow come into evidence later and be used as a kind of a public relations weapon against it as a, quote, undesired side effect. Do you feel that's such a cautionary note, or without being provocative or stating it's a fact, should be perhaps added to the notebooks and website in the light of your work?
I think a lot of women will be delighted. My view is that fertility is part of normal health, not disease. And what we'll say is that it's going to bring your fertility back to normal, to where it should be. And then obviously, if you want to become pregnant, you're going to be delighted. If you don't want to become pregnant, well, then you got to be sure to use your family planning, whatever your choice of family planning is. But I think that the perspective that I would take on it is, we want all of you to be healthy. And my view with fertility care is it's normal and healthy to be fertile, and that will come back to normal as well as a result of the treatment. But they're not going to get hyper fertile. In fact, I don't know how many women would get depression, say, for example, by being on hormonal contraception. I don't know what the number is. I just have very small numbers that, especially the girl with MS, and she was prone to depression. It got much, much worse when she was on the oral contraceptive pill. So family planning isn't an issue. She's 26 years old and single and not in a relationship. But she could track her cycle with our fertility care system and have the same reliability as hormonal contraception for avoiding pregnancy. So that's also an option as well. Yeah.
The main part of the lecture that I was interested in, you cut off at. You didn't get to.
I could give that to him privately later on.
In that case, PCO, can you make them ovulate with just low dose naltrexone?
If somebody comes to me with polycystic ovaries, I usually put them on. If I like to check insulin levels. If insulin levels are elevated, I usually put them on the glucophage to bring insulin levels down. But if they have enough criteria that would make them suitable for naltrexone, I've actually developed criteria to assess from an infertility perspective who would actually benefit from trying naltrexone as well. I could show you those criteria later. It kind of goes off on a tangent a little bit into the infertility world. But
I'd like to see that later.
I've been on LDN for about 2 years now. Prior to that, I got pregnant very easily with my son. I'm on it for MS. Now I'm thinking about number two. My question kind of relates over here. I get pregnant easily. I don't have any problems. Would you advise going off the LDN for any period of time before getting pregnant? Or I'm not sure if I've had a miscarriage, and I'm wondering if it was related to the LDN.
Well, you see, if there's a history of MS, I think you're at greater likelihood for increased problems with your fertility as well. So if you've got a regular cycle, and we can assess couples that are at risk of miscarriage before they ever even have one, and you can track your cycle, get a simple blood test for 7 days after you ovulate, and you could look at the parameters of your cycle, and if they look perfectly healthy, then you're fine. Now, stay on your naltrexone for at least the first 3, if not the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. I wouldn't go beyond 12 weeks because the growth inhibition, I'm a little suspicious that it might affect placental function and be adverse at that point. So I think, but maybe even 10 weeks might be enough.
Okay,
but I asked Dr. Hildreth this question because he's given naltrexone during pregnancy at a dose of 50 milligrams safely. It's also been given to women with heroin addicts during pregnancy safely as well, just the babies were lighter. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because of the effect on placental growth or function.
Thank you. Hi. Some people on the LDN chat rooms, some women especially, of course, reported that their menstrual cycle has shortened. Some women even have 2 periods per month as a side effect of LDN. First, they just thought of nothing of it, and then one person started and other people started. Have you noticed that in your patients? Are you tracking, their cycles and if they're shortening?
Yeah, well, the thing is they'd need to gather objective evidence of that, and I'm trained in the fertility care system, so if they tracked their fertility care cycle, then you get an objective. Is it transient? Is it for 1 month? Is it like the washing out period that the autism people get, that it's just for 2 or 3 months and then they're back to normal? I don't know. But it's a whole other area for collecting data and get more information on it. But I would suspect that it should restore normality, because I've one of my infertility patients that I've tried all the Clomid, I've tried all of our usual things unsuccessfully, and she felt awful. The only treatment she's on is naltrexone, and she has transformed her cycle, her bleeding pattern, her mucus flow, her hormone levels are completely perfect, and all her premenstrual symptoms are gone with naltrexone alone and nothing else.
If you're not getting other questions, if you want to take your last 5 minutes to give us the rest of your presentation, that would be great.
Okay, I'll see what I can do. Hang on. I knew I was a little overambitious because I had 120 slides. I tend to bite off a little more than I can chew. So this is the first infertility patient. And simply, nothing else was working for me. I tried all the usual treatment for her, and she had this horrible, intractable premenstrual symptoms. I think that's something that is largely ignored and usually treated very ineffectively with antidepressants, and it can respond beautifully to naltrexone. It's a piece of data well worth collecting. But anyway, I said, let's try a clinical experiment. I have nothing else to try. Let's put you on this. I put her on naltrexone alone with nothing else because I was going to go for FSH injections, and I just wanted her to have a laparoscopy before that. And nothing else was working for her. And basically, you can't tell it too well from here, but she had persistent brown bleeding during the menstrual flow, and her hormone levels were atrocious and nasty premenstrual symptoms. So I started LDN at that stage, and the brown bleeding disappeared from here of her cycle. The brown bleeding disappeared. Her cycle, she ovulated a little bit earlier and was getting a much better progesterone surge than she had done up until then, and she got pregnant. Now, her progesterone was good, but her estrogen was atrociously low, and we find if one or other of the hormones is too low, then you're high risk for miscarriage, and unfortunately, she did have a miscarriage. I've since sent her for a laparoscopy, and she was found to have moderately severe endometriosis, but I saw her just last week, and this girl came in smiling. Now, her history was she was in a road traffic accident 5 years ago, and ever since that accident, she just felt awful, and she couldn't say what it was, and this thing, a precipitant of some kind of trauma seems to be important. I heard Bernard Bahari talk about that before as well, and she had this precipitant, and I think that left her chronically endorphin deficient, and nothing we could do was going to get her to work. I think if this girl went for IVF, it wouldn't have worked for her either because of her chronic endorphin deficiency and all the problems that go with that as well. We've sorted her endometriosis. We got her healthy. We got her happy. She's ovulating well with good mucus and good hormones, so I'm very hopeful that this girl is going to have success in the near future. So I kind of picked my clinical criteria, and if a patient has resistant premenstrual symptoms that haven't improved despite our usual hormonal treatment, a personal or family history of an autoimmune disorder or endometriosis, from February of 2005, I was putting all patients coming to me with that kind of a profile on LDN. I put about 100 women on it at this stage. With clinical experience and practice, practicing the art of medicine by listening to my patients, I added more categories that I felt people that would be suitable candidates to give this a go if they wanted to. So NAPRO technology, I think, is especially suited to this because we get real-time daily biological feedback on the fertility chart that we work with from the bleeding pattern and all the other parameters that we look for. So I explain, look, this is an experiment. I usually start off and say, this is a drug for alcoholics and drug addicts. So I shock them first. And then I say, this is experimental. And then I give them the leaflet and I say, if you want to give it a try, it's safe, it's not going to do any harm, and we could try it. The other brackets of people that I extended to are those with this persistent debilitating fatigue, which is what that earlier girl had, just tired all the time. Sleep disturbance, persistent brown bleeding during the menstrual flow, depression. And I'm even considering it for male anti-sperm antibodies because that's autoimmune where the immune system attacks the male sperm for whatever reason. So I was already aware that there are immune factors involved, and I was picking this up in my clinical practice. And I had a patient who had two successful pregnancies with us. She had a history of two miscarriages. Her first pregnancy with us, she lost. And in her second pregnancy, right down here, her progesterone was brilliant. We got her to conceive with great hormones, but she had persistent PMT, persistent brown bleeding, hormones were going great, and bottomed out. She lost her previous pregnancy at 12 weeks with us, despite getting off to a perfect start. I had read somewhere that you could try prednisolone. I put her on prednisolone 5 milligrams a day when this started to happen. She started to get bleeding as well. and the bleeding stopped. I kept her on the prednisolone right the way through, and she had a successful pregnancy. So I said, I'm not sure what I treated there, but we saved the pregnancy. I think if I didn't do that, we would have lost it. After she delivered the baby, she developed a lupus-type rash, and she seemed to have SLE. And the specialist that she went to said that was the exact thing you should have been put on, steroids during your pregnancy. But I had no way of detecting that at the time. It was just a clinical hunch. So you could go with evidence-based medicine. What I did wasn't evidence-based. It was like a hunch, and we tried it, and we got a result with it. And at least I gave it under the umbrella of saying, I don't know for sure what I'm treating, but I know it's not going to do any harm, and it didn't. So then we tried for another one, and she had another miscarriage with us despite good hormones. And then we got another pregnancy and kept her on the steroids right the way through. And she had another, she's into our arty pictures, the nice ones to show. And so she had another successful pregnancy. And since then, that's the lupus rash that I told you about. But since then, she's trying for another baby, and we can't get her to ovulate with buckets of Clomid. I'm putting her on 20 tablets of Clomid, 4 a day for 5 days, and we just cannot get her hormones right. And she's rotten with PMT symptoms, and simply what we did was put her on her naltrexone. I had her on steroids as well, so we stopped the steroids, put her on the naltrexone, and we went for a low dose of Clomid, and now she's producing 2 and 3 eggs. So that naltrexone is far superior because she actually progressed. There's one other condition as well, in fact, that's very important, nasty menopausal symptoms. A lot of women that have horrible PMS during the reproductive life continue the curse during the menopause, and they get the worst menopause ever. And I'm very, very suspicious that that's based on endorphin deficiency. I have one patient that I've just started treatment on for that as well.
Thank you so much. Okay.